supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you this week, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we're going to answer three separate questions about tomatoes. What should you feed little baby ones? Do you really have to put eggshells in the planting hole? And can you feed your love apples with horse manure? We're also going to have a great interview about orchids in anticipation of a big orchid event coming up very soon. And that's a lot to do, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Rob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Rob from Iowa. How are you?
Very good. And you're in Iowa, so we already know that. How is Rob?
I'm good. Hey, I've been listening to your program a little bit, and I had a couple of questions, actually three questions, and I'll just kind of run through them real quick and kind of see if you can shed some light on some things.
They related, or are they totally different?
They're kind of different.
Okay, just hit me with the first one first.
Okay, so we have a hydrangea that's right next to our house, and it's just got enough space between our driveway and our house. It's not very big, but it was so beautiful 2 years ago. Last year it was kind of nice, kind of goes in cycles. But my question is, what's the best way to care for that so every year it gets a good set of blooms and flowers on them?
Did you prune it?
Well, the first year that we had it, not really knowing very much about it, all the stalks that were in it, we bought the house, and all the stalks that were sticking up, I cut everything off 6 to 8 inches above the ground, you know, at the top of kind of the bundle of the plant, I guess you'd call it.
And
then, you know, it didn't do much that year.
Right.
I think I did it in kind of early spring, maybe close to summer. But
here's the
it
deal.
Really
no,
do
I don't. I don't. I don't need to hear any of your other pruning misadventures. The biggest problem with hydrangeas is gardeners thinking that they have to prune them and then arbitrarily trying to decide when. Years ago, we had a hydrangea expert on the show who taught me the greatest trick in gardening. He says, leave the plant alone. Don't do anything to it. Let the plant grow in the spring because, you know, hydrangeas produce their flowers late spring, early summer. And when the flower heads appear, give them a little time to develop. And then, after all the flower heads are developed in opening, then you can go through the plant and take out any non-flowering stems that you want, especially ones that are hiding the flowers from view. You do that, you will never accidentally cut off a flower bud, and it will always look like your hydrangea is the fullest and most floriferous in the neighborhood.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea.
Okay, number two.
We have hostas that kind of surround a few of our trees in our backyard, and we are kind of on the edge of town. And so there are deer that come out of the woods not far from our house, and just about mid to late summer, they eat the hostas down to nubs.
The hostas are almost done by then, right?
Well, they're still big and beautiful by then. They go into the fall a little bit, but is there any way to keep the deer from getting at them or getting to them? Is there anything you can sprinkle or spray them with?
Well, yes, you would be spraying them regularly with a deer repellent that contained a high concentration of putrescent egg solids. You'll see a lot of repellents out there with a lot of ingredients, but only putrescent egg solids have been shown to work. And it's got to be a pretty high concentration. You got to spray them pretty heavily. Hostas are one of a deer's favorite foods. You might also try rigging up kind of a cage without a cage, running some stakes into the ground, and then running some fishing wire around the stakes at like 6-inch intervals so that as the deer try to bend over, they keep encountering these obstacles. I mean, obviously, caging them completely would be a good answer. If they were all concentrated in the front of your house, you could use a motion-activated sprinkler to chase the deer away. But that's the best answer, man, when you got like a dedicated vegetable garden or a big flower bed. But in the woods like that, you either have to put up some sort of confusing or protective structure or spray them about every 2 weeks with a very heavy concentration of a deer repellent with putrescent egg solids.
Okay. The last question is, we have a big lavender plant in one of our flower beds. Each year it grows and grows and grows. But how is the best, do you trim that back at the end of the year, the beginning of spring, so that every year you don't have all the dead matter in the new growing?
Especially in Iowa, you should not trim anything back at the end of the year. All you're doing is exposing it to greater winter injury. So you don't want to be cutting anything back in the fall. Yes, you can tidy it up first thing in the spring. Ideally, with a lot of plants like this, the best time is when you see the new growth appear. That's when you clean away the old brown growth you don't like looking at anymore.
Okay.
But don't prune anything in the fall. Go on vacation. Get out of town. Get out of Dodge.
Hey, that sounds great, Mike. Thanks so much for your help. I enjoy your program. Thank you.
My pleasure. You take care, man.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Lorraine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Lorraine. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
And where is Lorraine Fine?
In Broomall, Pennsylvania.
Right, just outside of Philadelphia.
Right.
Very good.
Yes.
What can we do for Lorraine?
I was listening to your show, and a caller asked a question about a hardy gardenia. And I wanted to let you know that I have two such plants in my yard.
Excellent, excellent.
And I've had them for 4 years.
I remember that show very clearly. That was a show where I knew nothing. We were playing endless rounds of Stump the Chump, and I was just being pounded into the concrete. Now, my knowledge of gardenias is limited to them being one of the absolute hardest to grow indoor house plants.
And yes, I have killed many.
I don't know. I think they get depressed and take their own plant lives. I mean, I've never had somebody offhandedly say, oh, yes, I have a house full of beautiful gardenias. And I knew that most people would take them outside in the summer. Mm-hmm. And that the plants seemed to respond really well to that. But when they were brought inside for the winter, because they weren't hardy, they would get all sullen and moody and start watching late night television and everything.
Right. But these love to be outdoors. And they do bloom all summer. And the flower is not as compact as it's not like a corsage gardenia. It's more open. But that the fragrance is there, and they're doing well.
Now, how did you acquire or come upon this plant?
Catalogs. I get a lot of catalogs, and I'm always reading, and I like tropical things, and so I'm always looking for, as we get warmer, what can I grow here? And I happen to see this frost-free, gardenia. So I tried it, and I have had them now.
Now, how did it describe their hardiness, their zones that they could survive in? And did it give you any special instructions? Are these things?
It just said zone 6 to 10, and it said they liked sun and some shade. One is like 2.5 feet tall, and the other one's like 3 feet tall now.
And they've survived a couple of winters.
Yes, uh-huh.
Now, we have to back off and say, this past winter only had a couple of weeks of winter, unfortunately, many of which came at the very end and into spring.
Mm-hmm.
But the winter before, there was no winter.
Right, but I have protected them with, a burlap around them. I must tell you, though, my daughter has one. She lives around the corner from me, and she does nothing to hers. her gardenia, and it's still fine.
And has it been in the ground longer than yours?
Just as long. I bought them all together.
Okay. I would urge her to follow your good example.
Yes, I'm trying.
Because a lifelong job, huh? Yeah. Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But yes, I think a harsh winter could harm the plants, but I'm going to look them up. I mean, botany is not my big thing. People who listen to the show realize my expertise is in growing vegetables, being organic, fighting mm-hmm. pests and disease. When you get deep into obscure ornamentals, I'm totally lost. But I love the fact that our listeners come in and bail me out. And I will learn more about these hardy gardenias. And my hope would be that even if you have a cold, cruel winter, that the roots would still survive and they would just
have to
put more biomass on. But that was the first I've heard of it. It's amazing. There's just so many plants out there. You're always going to hear about something new, even after being in the business 30 years.
This is a real nice one. I've had no problems with any insects or anything like that or diseases on them.
All right. Well, Lorraine, this is something I will now learn more about. Thank you. And thank you for recommending a plant that I know a lot of our listeners are going to want to look into.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody that it's the time of year for springtime plant sales, garden symposiums, and installations of giant insects. Listeners in the WHYY area will find details on those and lots of other local events listed on our website. And we also list events happening in other areas where we're on the local public radio station. So send those events in. But don't go composing that email or clicking on the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with a big orchid event, 3 Titanic tips for your tomatoes, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Verpie supports You Bet Your Garden. Verpie can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at verpie.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, everybody is waiting and thinking about getting those homegrown tomatoes in the ground. We'll help you get prepared with 3 tips about feeding baby plants, using calcium to prevent blossom end rot, and what you should do if you suddenly have access to big steaming piles of horse manure. We're also going to take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now, as promised, it is time to welcome our guest, Robert Sprague, who is the co-chair of the upcoming show for the Southeastern Pennsylvania Orchid Society, which will be held April 12th to the 14th for the very first time at the Academy of Natural Sciences in downtown Philadelphia on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, the International Orchid Show and Sale. Robert, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to meet you, Mike.
Now, tell us a little bit. These show and sales have been going on for many years and are held in the spring, and they involve an astounding number of orchids.
That's true. We have had this show for approximately 40 years. We're moving to the Academy for the first time this year in the hope of attracting a wider audience and hopefully a slightly larger audience.
Now, for those who are not familiar with Philadelphia, the Academy of Natural Sciences is on Logan Circle and quite near the famed Philadelphia Art Museum, the Franklin Institute, the astounding new installation of the Barnes Art Collection. This is a cultural mecca. But the Academy of Natural Sciences has always been about dinosaurs and dioramas. It's almost weird to have a lot of living things in there.
Well, that's true to a certain extent, but it's not just about dinosaurs and rocks and fish and dead things. It's about science in general. And there is a lot of active science going on out in the field having to do with conservation and water quality. And so there is a large botany department as well with thousands of specimens, including about 8,000 dried specimens of orchids. And among those are the collection of the Lewis and Clark expedition, and there are some orchids in there that were collected in that famed exploration.
Which is, I believe, as an orchid enthusiast, I'm talking you, not me, that is one of your specialties, is Native American orchids, which I love talking about because we always surprise people who didn't know that there were such things. They think of orchids as just the epiphyte type in the fabulous rainforest hanging down with moss and monkeys around.
Absolutely. It's astonishing to a lot of people when we tell them that there are, in fact, about 50 species of orchids that grow wild in natural settings in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And one of the exhibits that we will have, in fact, is a photo exhibit of those plants that are in the orchid family from our local area.
However, sir, it says here on my notes that you will also have the live thing, that you're going to actually have an exhibit of yellow lady slippers in bloom, which is, to my mind, really difficult to do.
Well, that's true. It's a little bit early for their blooming time in nature, probably 3 to 4 weeks. But Mount Cuba Center, which specializes in native plants of the Atlantic Piedmont region, has yellow lady slippers and a couple of other species related lady slipper species that they are forcing right now. And they will be in bloom and will be incorporated in an exhibit of those plants from Mount Cuba. But that's only a small part of the show. We actually will have 36 exhibits. Most of those are from local societies, and the rest are from vendors from around the world. And they will put on exhibits which will be basically epiphytic orchids in a variety of settings. There will be approximately 1,200 blooming orchid plants that are registered for judging, and they will be on display in these various exhibits.
Now, we should explain for those who don't know, an epiphyte is a plant that has strong roots that latch onto other plants, but unlike a parasite, doesn't take any nutrition from the plant. It's actually, you know, these ones in the Amazon, they're just hanging on to the trees so they don't fall down, right?
That's correct. And in fact, we just came back from the Amazon basin and saw a lot of orchids in its natural setting. They do not take any sustenance from the host plant. It's simply a support. And that's the way most of them grow in nature if they're not the terrestrials. We put them in pots because that's a convenient way for us to
just to make them stand up.
That's all it is. It's simply a means to have them sit on a bench or a table or your windowsill.
And that's why most of these pots are filled with very rough bark or anything that is not soil, because most epiphytes would die if they were planted like a regular plant.
Absolutely. Orchid roots need to have air. and they need to be able to dry out as they do in nature. You get rain maybe every day in the rainy season, but it's a brief period, and then the roots can dry out at night, and so fungus and bacteria do not have a chance to damage the plant.
And, you know, I hear from people who get this advice to feed their orchids these heavy chemical plant foods, and I'm thinking when these things are hanging up in the trees, every time it rains, they might be getting a little nutrition from some of the moss, but nobody's spreading chemical fertilizers. These are plants that have learned, like a lot of plants that I really love, to look spectacular and just be drop-dead gorgeous with very little nutrition, and it's very easy to push them in the other direction and make them look ugly with overfeeding.
Absolutely correct. It's magic. I mean, how does a plant get sustenance? How does it get carbohydrates out of thin air? Well, as you suggested, it comes from the host plant and the falling leaves and vegetative matter that collects in the crotch of a tree or along a branch. And some of the experts today who talk about gardening indoors with orchids don't talk a lot about fertilization. It's not the most important thing. Water is the most important thing. Too much is as bad as too little. They talk about the medium that you put the plants in. It has to dry out, and it has to give air to the roots. Fertilization can be important, and good fertilization regimen will actually enhance the growth of the plant and provide bigger and better flowers sometimes than we see in nature. But isn't that the manner of all things gardening?
Everybody knows about the one orchid that is fairly safe for people to buy on Valentine's Day and Mother's Day, and that's the Phalaenopsis or moth orchid. If you're smart, you buy it with just a few flowers open and a million unopened buds. And if you just leave it alone, if you don't try to help it, typically that orchid will bloom for up to 6 months, right? Those flowers opening.
That's absolutely correct. That's the plant that is most recommended, most often recommended for beginners. It requires conditions that are very similar to African violets. So folks that can do that, put your Phalaenopsis in the same kind of a habitat. That's probably in a windowsill, not too bright light, but enough light, and water not too often, maybe weekly, depends on the humidity, depends on the amount of sunshine, but you want to let the medium, the bark mixture, all but dry out before you rewater again. And never let it sit in a saucer like you do with other plants.
We don't recommend that anyone let their plants sit in a saucer of water. They can use the saucer to protect the surface, but make sure if there's any water in that, you pour it out or suck it out with a turkey baster.
That's correct.
You literally could go on forever because this is the largest family of plants. There are untold numbers of species and genus and
probably
varieties.
30,000 and counting native species of orchids.
And that's probably a lowball figure.
It probably is. We had a speaker very recently back from Ecuador where he's climbing mountainsides on a daily basis with groups of students and interns and discovering 3, 4, 6, 8, 10 species of orchids on one mountainside in a week. And the unique thing is they're endemic to that one mountainside. You go down the valley and up the next mountain, and it's all different microclimates.
And that's a great place to stop because I want to end with a warning that we always do that I was taught years and years ago by a guest, which is about the Native American lady slippers and other terrestrial orchids, that if you find them, just enjoy them and leave them be because they're growing in conditions that are absolutely perfect that you couldn't replicate in your backyard if you tried. And if you want to try, there are commercial starts available where people have grown these, not collected from the wild. But if you come upon a patch of native orchids, this is not for touching. This is for looking at and enjoying, and probably to be safe, don't tell anybody else about it.
Well said. And to those who don't heed your advice and try, always fail. It's very rare to be able to transplant a native orchid, and that's got to do with a lot of more complicated science involving fungi in the soil, and we don't know how to identify that totally and control it. So,
but I imagine people will be able to learn what you do know about it at the Orchid Show and Sale, April 12th to the 14th, at the Academy of Natural Sciences, right on Logan Circle on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway in downtown Philadelphia. Robert Sprague, co-chair of the show for the Southeastern Pennsylvania Orchid Society, thanks so much for talking about orchids with us today on You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for inviting us. We appreciate the chance to talk about the show.
And now back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Eleanor, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, Eleanor. Where are you?
Well, actually, now I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And where in Philly?
Oh, actually, Center City on the Avenue of the Arts.
Really? You live on Broad Street?
No, I'm at work.
Oh, I see. I guess your question has nothing to do with the Avenue of the Arts, however.
No, we also own a home down in Tuckerton, New Jersey, a summer home that Sandy had the misfortune of visiting this past fall. And it's been a problem that I've had for years down there. Now, Sandy just totally covered every inch of my property, 2 feet of water in the house. I've had trouble for years gardening down there because not only Sandy comes along, but every year the nor'easter winter storms flood our property.
Oceanfront gardening is a hard thing, and it's important to remember that you literally cannot transfer like a backyard garden in South Philly or a beautiful vegetable patch in the Northeast and put it at the edge of an ocean. The plants that can survive in that kind of environment are very limited and very specific and ideally should be dedicated to helping manage the water and protecting the land that's behind the plants.
Well, that's the thing. I've gone from nursery to nursery on the internet and all kinds of things trying to find different salt grasses that will survive, and they last a couple years and then they're gone, and then I replant. And my vegetable garden, though, my husband raised somewhat and lined with plastic so that the salt water wouldn't seep up into the garden.
No, that's a sucker bet.
Yeah, well, for quite a few years I did okay, but now the last several years, not only Sandy's come along, but just the tides keep rising, and my vegetable garden has been covered in salt so many times now that I just don't even think I can plant there anymore.
Well, I think you're right, but you do spend the entire summer down there, right?
Well, I used to, but now I'm back to working 4 days a week, so I
get
down
there. So you're really
there.
Only there on the weekends. Where do you live the rest of the time?
Philadelphia, in Ronhurst.
Can you have a garden there?
Yes, I have a small garden there, but I was trying to transfer my talents down to the property in New Jersey. And like I said, when I spent the summers there, I did a little bit better.
I think you're not facing reality here, Eleanor.
Yeah, you're right. After 15 years, I think you're right.
Absentee gardening is really difficult in the best of conditions. In extreme conditions like that, it becomes almost impossible. So there's a couple of things I want you to do. Your local extension service for that area of New Jersey will know exactly the right kind of plants to put in to kind of rebuild the dunes, rebuild the natural plantings that can hold sand and soil in place. They may even have a program to help you acquire them, or they may supply them or help you with the planting. But where I've seen this work really well, in places like Bethany Beach, a little further south, it's been an entire community working together, and they've done dramatic things at almost like pushing the ocean back. If you want some living things to be down there when you're on the weekend, I think you're a prime candidate for tabletop gardening.
Yes, I've tried the large pot. And this year, Sandy washed them away on me, too.
No, but see, what I'm suggesting is even more extreme. I'm suggesting you get a nice picnic table or something and line the top of the picnic table with rectangular planters and put in nice flowers and perhaps pepper plants, some eggplants, bush string beans. Not tomato plants or anything that's going to grow real tall. Those you should still grow at home because those you want to see when they're ripe and everything like that. Tomatoes need to be picked when they're dead ripe. You don't want them sitting out for 5 days down the shore in the hot sun waiting for you to come back. They'll be tasteless. But you could grow an awful lot on top of a picnic table in containers filled with soil-free mix and compost. And that would be, by definition, raised a couple of feet. The plants will shield each other. The bulk of the plants will be like a tight square foot garden, intensive raised bed system. And otherwise, deal with your local county extension office for recommendations on plants to go in the ground. You get the right plants in the ground, you can help moderate the effects of future storms.
I sure hope we never see another Sandy.
Well, the odds are not going to go that way, Eleanor, so better to be prepared. Okay, but good luck. We love the Jersey Shore.
Yes, we do.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be appearing at the Delaware Home Show in Dover this Saturday and Sunday, April 6th and 7th, at the Fishing Creek Herb Guild in Bloomsburg, PA on Thursday, April 18th, at the Community Home Show in Ocean Pines, Maryland on Saturday, April 27th, at the Compost Awareness Day in Manassas on May 4th, and at the Landis Valley Museum Herb and Garden Fair on May 11th. Don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and three tips that will help you grow Titanic tomatoes. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Tomato Growing Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee can help do the gardening for you with garden-ready plants. Tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, herbs, and more, delivered at planting time in your region. These and more can be seen online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week, which is three questions of the week. What do I feed baby tomato plants and when? Do I have to use eggshells to supply the necessary calcium to my plants? And I have access to lots of horse manure. Will that grow me great tomatoes? We'll answer all those questions after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Abe, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing very well, Abe. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks a lot for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from Egg Harbor Township, which is about Egg Harbor Township, New Jersey, which is about 15 miles outside of Atlantic City.
What can we do for Abe in Egg Harbor?
I have a question concerning what I believe is a emerald green arborvitae.
Arborvitae, yeah.
Okay, arborvitae. It's about 12 feet tall. It sits in front of my house or on the corner of my house. And over the last couple of seasons, it's gotten a little beat up by some high winds and some snow. And the problem is that it started to lean quite heavily away from the home, and I had to stake it up. And the area around it's actually growing kind of soggy. So it's not really taking well to that spot again, trying to regain its strength and its roots.
Right.
So my question is really two-part. The first part is, it's a big tree. I really don't want to cut it down and just dispose of it. I'd really like to try to transplant it to another part of my property if possible, and I'm hoping that if it's possible to do that. And my second part of that question is the location where I want to put it. It would be about 5 or 6 feet from where I had a silver maple, which also got destroyed in a derecho that came through and kind of took it down, and I had to have it removed. So I was wondering if that's even possible, because I know the roots tend to be quite invasive.
Okay, so you took down a silver maple, but you didn't have the stump pulled or the roots taken up.
I had it ground down, ground level.
It's the worst. I got a real beef with arborists who are doing this, because it's the worst of two worlds. I mean, if you leave a visible stump in the ground, at least people know the plug is in the bathtub. But you grind it down to ground level, and you have achieved nothing positive except you've hidden the fact that what looks like soil to the naked eye, it might as well be a concrete slab.
Oh.
Once they grind it down, it's a dog to remove. I mean, they've removed a lot of the ability to grab hold of it now.
Oh, I see.
So, you know, if you can regrade it and cover it with topsoil, you might be able to get a decent lawn to grow there, although there are going to be lots of mushrooms popping up as that wood degrades. Now, I'm sure somebody can pull the stump now, but it would have been a heck of a lot cheaper to get it all done at the same time. So right now, no, that is not a good spot for the arborvitae. But yes, the arborvitae should not be sitting in an area that does not drain well. Do you have any other places?
Yes, I definitely do. Along that same fence, but much further away, and I can still make use of it there. It wasn't my first choice, but absolutely, yes.
Okay, so here's the deal. Here's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to get a whole bunch of your buddies together. This is going to be like a six-guy job.
Yeah,
and,
quite big.
And it sounds like you can rock this thing out of the ground. Its roots are not stable.
Now.
Okay. Well, and then you're going to, there was a time when my son had to move like around the corner, and I convinced him the smartest thing to do with the big couch was to just get a bunch of guys and walk it. Actually, it was more like four blocks, but, you know, it made a lot more sense. You know, it's like pallbearers. You get enough guys on all sides wearing good heavy gloves. You lay the thing on its side. The smart money would say you lay it on a tarp.
Yeah, that's what I was shooting for. Hopefully they just drag it with a lot less.
No, you get enough guys, you can lift it up in the air. Dragging would be bad.
Even if you lay it across a tarp?
You don't want to be dragging the tarp. You'll break up the root ball, you'll disturb the roots.
Okay.
Some of your branches are already shattered, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you want to go for the gold here and break them all?
No.
So buy a case of good beer, get that big tarp, get a bunch of guys over, dig the planting hole. When you replant the arborvitae, if for any reason it was planted with the wrappings still around, get rid of them. Any trace of the old burlap or a metal cage or anything like that. don't improve the soil in the new hole. And don't dig a deep hole. Dig a wide hole. And you want it to be sitting up high. Ideally, I know this is counterintuitive, but you want to see the little bit of the root flare above ground. You don't want it to look like a lollipop.
Okay? Oh, really?
You will get good lateral root growth, and you'll get a tree that will stabilize itself very quickly.
Oh, that's great. That's really good news. It's much better than I expected.
And do it before the summer heat arrives. Okay?
Okay.
And keep it really well watered after you get it in the ground.
Sounds great.
All right. Good luck, Abe.
Thank you very much. Have a nice day.
You too. Take care, man. 1-888-346-9499. Marty, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How you doing?
I'm doing good. Marty, how are you, sir?
I'm pretty good.
And where is Marty pretty good?
Norman, Oklahoma.
Ah, Storeman Norman, one of our two favorite places in Oklahoma, right next to Oklahoma City. What can we do for you, sir?
Yes, I have a red maple. I planted it, probably 4 or 5 years back. And the tree is just going straight up. I mean, it's not spreading out the bottom. And it's just going, just straight up. I mean, I thought they were to kind of branch out on the bottom a little bit.
No. A maple tree is a maple tree, and trees in general, except for evergreens, tend to want to do most of their action at the top in kind of a canopy. And most people don't want lower branches because they get in their way, they interfere with mowing. Is the tree leafing out up top nicely?
Oh, yeah, it leafs out, and it does everything it's supposed to do. I mean, when I bought it, I looked at the little tag on there, and bright orange leaves. It's doing what it's supposed to do. But I've got two big blackjack oak trees. They're about 30 feet away. I thought maybe they were kind of competing for the sun,
Well,
it's normal then.
Yes, but if the trunk seems to be unusually elongated, if it seems a little tall and a little thinner than you might expect, that is a sign of a plant that is struggling for light. I mean, if you put yourself in the place of this maple tree that's, seemingly not getting enough sun, what's the smartest thing you can do is try to grow taller faster. This is true of so many plants. People are doing this now all across the country. When they're starting their own tomato plants and they don't give them enough light, or they put them in what they think is a sunny windowsill that's actually a death sentence for the tomato plant, they get these tall, thin plants, and we call that legginess, and that is literally the plant desperately trying to get closer to the sun, trying to get closer to light. But in Oklahoma, in Norman, which is hot and bone dry in the summertime and has winds that make Chicago look like a AA team, you really need a concentration of plants to kind of protect each other. The health of a tree is always going to be gauged by how well it leafs out in the springtime.
Okay.
I can even tell you, if your tree starts dropping its leaves suddenly in a hot summer about halfway through, you wouldn't even worry about that. That's a natural reaction to stress.
Okay.
But as long as the canopy is nice and the colors are nice, there's nothing wrong. Part of that is the habit of the tree, but part of it is in a normal place, it would probably want to be more in the open. But in Oklahoma, where you are, it's probably doing as well as it is because it's protected from your constant high winds.
Yeah. My question about it also is the bark on the side. I got one little spot on a tree that the bark wanted to peel off, and I don't know what the cause of that was. But
sometimes some plants have what's called exfoliating bark, where that's perfectly normal. Some plants where there's extremes of hot and dry, the bark will split a little bit. Don't worry about it. Anytime something like that happens, the worst thing you can do is try to fix it or help it. Always look to how the tree leafs out in springtime. If it looks like a healthy tree when it leafs out, don't change a thing. Just keep doing what you're doing.
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Good luck. All right. As promised, it's time for the questions of the week. Three timely tomato topics: feeding your seedlings, adding calcium, and what you should do with horse manure. You Bet Your Garden producer Alexis Landis, please read us the first of this week's trio of titanic questions.
Well, Mike, we'll start with Susan in Berwyn, Pennsylvania, who writes, I started my own tomato plants this year. They're indoors under lights, and so far, so good. I use Natural Beginnings Soilless Mix as the growing medium, and the package says to start feeding when the seedlings are 4 weeks old. I would like to use fish emulsion because that's what I have on hand. Can you tell me what strength to use?
Well, I also use Natural Beginnings. It's a very nice seed starting mix. Two natural materials that provide the drainage that young plants require: Core, a peat moss substitute made from coconut husks, and Perlite, a volcanic glass, plus a touch of two natural fertilizers, worm castings and mealworm guano, or in other words, two different kinds of worm poop. Now, those wonderful wormy excrements give baby plants a nice gentle feeding all the time, the same kind they'd receive in a natural setting, where leaf litter encourages earthworms to live nearby and poop out plant food. And 4 weeks sounds just about right to start giving your plants a little more food. But I would never use something as odoriferous as fish emulsion indoors. At least not again. I can still hear my wife yelling at me 25 years ago. Always consider the smell factor when you're using indoor plant food. Now, I've tried many different fertilizers on baby plants over the years, and I've finally settled on worm castings as the best. They're easy to find, they have no odor, and they give the plants a gentle, natural feeding. I just top off the soil with about an inch of castings when I move my starts up into bigger pots. Or you could water the plants with some worm poop tea. Just save that fish emulsion for outdoor use.
Well, Mike, we also heard from Erica in Wellington, Colorado, who says that's about 75 miles north of Denver and 35 miles south of Cheyenne. She writes, I've been reading your book, The You Bet Your Garden Guide to Growing Great Tomatoes, and holy cow, the mistakes I've been making. One thing I'm going to improve upon for sure is adding calcium to prevent blossom end rot. But you recommend using eggshells for this, and I'm not sure I can collect enough shells in time for planting. If I use an organic tomato food that specifies it contains added calcium, will it be as beneficial? Or is the power of eggshells hard to duplicate? Thanks.
Well, first, thanks for buying my tomato book, Erica. That's another 47 cents in the retirement fund. Ka-ching. Now, the short answer is that natural fertilizers that specify they contain added calcium should be fine, preventing the heartbreak of blossom end rot, improving the flavor of your love apples, and doing all the other good things that calcium does for tomatoes. I started specifically recommending adding crushed eggshells to the hole at planting time because I found it was just a great way to use up my eggshells. We seem to eat just enough eggs over the course of a season to provide a dozen crushed shells for each of my tomato plants and cucumbers, since I learned that adequate soil calcium keeps them nice and crispy, and I have found eggshells to be stubbornly recalcitrant when put into compost piles.
And finally, we also heard from Jean in Ambler, Pennsylvania, who writes, my daughter recently started taking riding lessons, and I now find myself with access to horse manure. Is this a good thing to add to my veggie or flower gardens? And if so, how? Is there a way to liquefy it? Would a manure tea feeding help my peppers, tomatoes, cucumbers, and summer squash? Thanks.
If I had a dollar for every time somebody has come up to me and said, my grandparents only used horse manure and had the best tomatoes around, I'd be a lot closer to that retirement fund. But I can't recall anyone ever saying that they personally layered their garden in equine excrement and had a good experience. First, horse manure must be thoroughly composted before use. Horses have very inefficient digestive systems that pass lots of seeds through without any harm to the seeds. So anyone foolish enough to use fresh horse manure in their plots will spend the summer battling ferocious weeds. And the weeds will win. And fresh manure in any form is so hot with nitrogen that it can injure or burn plants. Now, stable sweepings are a combination of the two things the horse decided to get rid of and the bedding used to keep the stalls clean and less slippery. And piling up this combination of nitrogen-rich waste and dry brown bedding produces a material that, when finished, is dry, crumbly, and virtually odorless. But it still is not compost. It is composted manure, and it is still overly rich in nitrogen, the nutrient that grows big plants but that can inhibit fruiting and flowering. That makes completely composted horse manure a perfect fertilizer for plants that like a lot of nitrogen, like sweet corn and lawn grasses, but less than ideal for fruiting crops like tomatoes and peppers. Well, that sure was some interesting information on growing tomatoes now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over with links to lots more information about Love Apple Care. To get started, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to cancel my calcium if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime. At 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. And perhaps you should check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems in our Garden Answers A to Z section. Listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar are You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, used to tease little boys with worms from the garden when she was growing up. Our esteemed editor, Al Banks, is a certified friend of worms. Just plain certified is Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia and can't wait for our new intern to start next week. I'm essentially useless at organizational matters, Mike McGrath, but I do make my own worm poop. Okay, that came out badly. I mean, you know, what I meant to say, I have a big worm bin, and the worms inside my red wigglers do that for me, transforming my kitchen waste into garden gold. I don't make it myself. At any rate, I'll see you and your worms next week. Do trees need mulch? And are exposed roots a sign of danger to your home? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll tell the truth about trees. Plus your fabulous phone calls.